ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the Country Hour on this Anzac Day. In a moment, a history lesson on the Australian Women's Land Army and the pivotal role that it played in keeping Australian agriculture going during World War II.
If I don't know about the Australian women who gave up their city lives and went to the country, then surely I can't be alone. So that set me off down the rabbit hole of discovering the really important role that these women played in World War II in actually keeping our troops and the country fed.
Also today, the stories of three men who served in World War I and were laid to rest in the Katherine District. And before 1:30, an update on a major fire ant outbreak that's been discovered in Queensland.
This is the first time that fire ant nests have been found in the Murray-Darling Basin. So this is really serious outbreak.
This is all coming up on today's Country Hour. Hope you can stick around. We are broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC, streaming online, and g'day there if you have tuned in via the podcast. First up today, I've got a story for you about carting 31 stock horses from New South Wales up into Queensland, through the Northern Territory and into the Kimberley. This has become an annual trip for horseman Gus Rose and his mate Simon Cheatham, who's the founder of the business Ringers from the Top End. Simon and Gus were tracking these horses through Mataranka this morning when I gave them a call.
Yeah, Matt. So basically, my mate Gus Rose and I, Gus runs a business called Rose Livestock, and he basically procures and transport horses for northern stations. And so the last couple of years, I've jumped in the truck with Gus to give him a hand, and we just took off late last week. We've got our biggest load, 31 horses, for leaving from Coffs Harbour, where Gus basically lives and gets his horses from New South Wales and Queensland. And we load them up into a road train, take off from Coffs Harbour, and we make our way up through Queensland, through Augustella, up through Winton and Mount Isa and Camelwheel on the border there, stopping a few times every night to take the horses off and give them a feed and a water. And we have a bit of a rest ourselves. So a couple of times through there, through Queensland, we do that. And then up through the territory, across the Barkly, we dropped a few horses off at number 7 yards, Newcastle Waters there. And then we stopped last night at Dally Waters. And that's a good long stay for the horses. They get a good feed and a water, and we have a couple of beers at the Dally Waters there. And
how far do you have to go? Where does the trip end?
The trip ends. It's a good question. We've done about 3,500 k's. We're at Mataranka, speaking to you from Mataranka. And so we'll head up to Katherine, take a left at Katherine there, and then across to Kununurra. We do quarantine at Kununurra. Drop a few horses off there for Diggers Rest Station.
Oh, yes.
And then on to Liveringa. And Liveringa, we drop off about a dozen horses there. And for Meter Station as well there in the West Kimberley. And then across to Pardoo, Port Hedland. And then I'll probably at that stage, Matt, I'll jump ship from Gus. I've got to get back to Beef Week in Rockhampton and prepare for Beef Week. So I get the easy trip home on a Qantas flight.
And poor Gus has to drive back by himself.
So Gus goes, he'll go back down via Perth, and he might even try and load up some cattle and take those back to New South Wales across the Nullarbor. So, yeah, it's a particularly big trip for Gus.
How did this trip all come about? This is a long way to sell horses.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's Gus's business. It's a good way for me to, jump in the truck and get out of the office and see stations and see my clients for Ringers from the Top End jobs. So that's great, and see the country. But Gus, there's a need for top end stations You know, the breeding programs can be difficult. So they do need to sort of rotate their horses.
Yep.
And there's definitely a demand there. And Gus provides that. He procures and puts together a portfolio for the station so they know what they're getting. Yeah, and trying to obviously get a range of horses for ringers. You know, you've got first-year jackaroos there that might need a quieter horse. So he's tailoring very much the type of horse to the ringer. And then you might have your head stockman or your leading hands are a bit more experienced that want a horse who can do certain things on the station.
Hey, how's the Barkley looking?
The Barkley's looking sensational. Very wet. The road's open. Bit of water on the road, but, you know, it's really wet. And talking to a few station owners last night from Sturt Station and Hayfield, you know, they're pretty much still, you know, just doing jobs around the station until it dries out. It's just still too wet to be doing mustering out there on horses and vehicles.
And you woke up this morning in Daly Waters. Can you tell us a bit about the dawn service? What was it like there?
Yeah, that was great, Matt. We had a good sleep last night and we woke up at about 5 and Tim, who runs Daly Waters, had the dawn service. They had a range of servicemen. They had the Air Force in there and it was a great service, an excellent turnout, you know, complete with donkeys and goats and steers and horses that just roam around freely. That's typical to the Daly Waters pub. An excellent turnout and a moving service and the last post, you know, you couldn't want for a better than the Daly Waters pub there. For such a remote location, I think there would have been, you know, a couple of hundred people there, which was great.
Wow. Yeah. Well, safe.
We couldn't hang around for the tour.
Yeah, Gus is just saying we're disappointed we couldn't hang around for the tour, which I'll tell you what, by about 7 a.m, all the servicemen were in the pub there having a few off the tap. So I reckon it'll be a big day there today.
Wouldn't you love to be at Daly Waters this afternoon? Absolutely. Hey, to you and Gus and the horses, all the best for the rest of the trip. That's quite an adventure.
Mate, thanks very much, Matt, and always great to talk to you, mate, and thanks for your support.
Simon Cheatham, he is from Ringers from the Top End. It is 22-1.
My name's Jess Daniels. I'm a biosecurity liaison with the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association, and you're listening to Country Hour.
Broadcasting on Anzac Day, I trust you are well. Well, midway through World War II, it was clear the war would not end quickly, and Australia desperately needed to keep its farms and primary industries operating. Thousands of women around the nation answered that call, and the Australian Women's Land Army was born. To learn more about this, Fiona Breen spoke to author and researcher Victoria Perman.
I didn't know Australia had a women's land army during World War II. I knew vaguely that the UK had set up land armies in World War I and II, but it wasn't until I was researching a previous book that I came across, I love looking at old newspapers, and I came across an article about a women's land army. And I thought, if I don't know about the Australian women who gave up their city lives and went to the country, then surely I can't be alone. So that set me off down the rabbit hole of discovering the really important role that these women played in World War II in actually keeping our troops and the country fed.
Well, we often hear about the land armies in the UK, etc., but we did the same kind of thing here, what, sort of midway through the Second World War?
Yeah, the land army began in 1942. I think when people started to realise the war was going to go on, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of men had enlisted to serve, 990,000 Australians, in fact. So there was a big shortage in the agricultural industries. So it wasn't just about feeding Australians, it was about supplying all those foodstuffs for the troops as well. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people needed feeding. So the federal government, reluctantly at first, and some of the agricultural organisations, I must say, were reluctant at first to establish such a thing, but they had no choice, actually. They were desperately in need of workers. So in 1942, the Land Army was created. and 6,000 women signed up.
They advertised? Do you know if there
they
was some
did
sort
advertise,
of campaign?
Yes. Yeah. They advertised, and there were beautiful ads in the women's magazines. I used the Women's Weekly ads at the time, which portrayed the life of a land girl as energetic and healthy and outdoors. And they were the best kind of propaganda, in a sense, that they were women doing country things in the fresh air, and it all looked fantastic. And for some of them, it was that life, but it was hard work, as anyone who farms or, you know, has property in the regions would know.
What sort of women applied to become part of the land army?
They were women from the cities, office workers, those who were doing clerical work, shop assistants, who wanted that big adventure. And some were motivated by that sense of adventure. Others were motivated because they had family who had enlisted, many in their families had enlisted, and they too wanted to do their bit. I did read about one land girl who was so angry that her brother had been given a white feather. Which, you know, was a sign of cowardice. And men, for a whole range of reasons, couldn't enlist. Perhaps they're in essential services back here in Australia, or perhaps they had a disability that might not have been obvious to others. But yeah, there was white feathers being handed out. And she was so furious at this, she decided to enlist in the land army. So they had all kinds of reasons, really. But I think, you know, 66,000 women in Australia signed up for in branches of the women's services. Yeah, and some were nurses right on the front lines in hospital ships. But there were other women who gave up their comfortable lives and put on overalls and
moved out to the country.
Moved out to the country. All over Australia, from, you know, picking cotton in Queensland to working in apple orchards in Tassie, picking cherries in South Australia and oranges in Gosford. They worked everywhere there was a need for agricultural labour.
And that's the sort of things they did. They harvested. Do you know, have you heard any other stories?
They did. They harvested all kinds of crops. They drove tractors to plough fields. Some actually worked as technical assistants in the forerunner of the CSIRO. They did everything that was necessary. And a story that I particularly loved was when flax supplies dried up from Europe because of obviously the war, the English government worked with the Australian government to plant flax. Flax, as we know, makes linen, and that linen thread was used for parachutes and shoelaces and all kinds of things. So Australia created a flax industry, and women were needed to work there, and it was hard work.
And so they kept these, well, they started that one, but they kept a lot of primary industries going through the war. So quite vital, some of that work.
They certainly did. And I've set my book, The Land Girls, partly in Mildura, because Mildura had per head the highest enlistment rate in the country. And I thought that was a really interesting place to set the book, because it was the hub of the dried fruits industry. So the dried fruits were not only important for people at home, but they were in ration packs. Dried sultanas were in ration packs for the boys who were away. And anyone who made a fruit cake to send to a loved one had dried fruit in it. So I had my characters go up to Mildura to work in that industry. Women were doing everything.
That's spuds, fantastic. Yeah.
Apples, pears, beans, grapes, cotton, everything.
That is author and researcher Victoria Perman, who based one of her novels around the work that women did helping to feed Australia during World War II. It is 17 to 1. You are tuned in to The Country Hour. We're broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC this Anzac Day. In a moment, I've got an update for you on a major fire ant outbreak that's been discovered on some defence land in Queensland. But first, let's have a tune. This morning, I got a message from a cattle station near Dunmara, and it said, "Matt, got a bit of a banger song request for you today, and I think it will fit." And I totally agree. It's a great song. Very appropriate on this day. And it's by John Williamson. I hope you enjoy it. It's Diggers of the Anzac. A A tremendous song request today from one of our territory cattle stations. If there's a song you feel we should be playing in the second half of the Country Hour today on this Anzac Day, send it through on that text line 0487 99 1057.
If healthy living is your thing, the ABC Listen app has all the podcasts. Try the health report.
These are ultra-processed products, and if you compare the calories,
you might also like What's That Rash?
You're talking about zits.
Teenagers love to go.
Or Life Matters.
Love online after 50.
It took me 18 months to download my first dating app.
Get your health kicks anywhere, anytime with the ABC Listen app.
A fire ant infestation on defence land in Queensland continues to grow and has authorities extremely worried. The number of nests found at Oakey now sits at 110, and the base hasn't been completely searched yet. Jack Goffs from the Invasive Species Council, he says the sheer number of nests is of great concern, and this outbreak means that fire ants are now in the Murray-Darling Basin.
Yeah, so last week when we got the news, we were very concerned because this is the first time that fire ant nests have been found west of the Great Divide in the Murray-Darling Basin. And so this is at a place called Oakey, about 29 kilometres west of Toowoomba, in the Condamine system, right at the tip of that system. And obviously we know with fire ants, one of their ways that they can move is through floodwaters where they form these rafts. So we've been long warning about fire ants getting into the Murray-Darling Basin system as a big red light flashing. What we've heard since, though, is on Monday we found out that that one nest that they'd found was now 78 nests. And then yesterday we found out that we're talking about 110 nests that they've found. So this is really serious outbreak. The number and density of those nests at this army base in Oakey suggests that the fire ants have been there a number of years, which from our perspective suggests that there has been a massive failure of surveillance by defence. And this is something that's really concerning, something that the former Inspector General of Biosecurity, Helen Scott-Orr, raises a particular concern in her 2021 report, which was a review report for the government, was defence, what they were doing on their lands in southeast Queensland and the high risk that they posed to the program, the eradication program, in terms of if fire ants were getting away on that federal land.
So does this mean they've been there for years and they've done nothing about them?
Well, hopefully they've not found them and done nothing about them. It means that, yeah, they've been there for years and they haven't found them. And that's a massive failure of surveillance. The defence have known that fire ants are a huge issue in southeast Queensland. This is a government agency. They should be leading the way in terms of looking for, making sure that they're doing the work with the eyes in the field, checking if there are fire ants on their land. And clearly they have not done that to the level that's required, because the number of nests that we're talking about now, at least 110, and my understanding is they haven't finished checking the full site either, and that this number could go up, suggests that we've had an infestation there well outside the biosecurity zone. This is, much more than 100 kilometres west of Brisbane, and they've been there for years. And obviously the chance then of them spreading to new locations is really high when fire ants have been there.
And we don't know how they got there?
We don't, and that's something that I guess
That's another issue.
Yeah, the program are doing the DNA testing to see, and obviously because it's an airbase, there is also the possibility that this is actually a separate infestation.
So they flew them in from somewhere maybe?
Potentially. Look, we don't know that yet. They're doing the checking. It could be from the Brisbane outbreak, but we do know that fire ants have turned up at other ports of entry. So in Gladstone, at Port Botany, in Perth as well, at the port there, where from overseas. All of those occasions, they've been identified quickly, and there has been an effective eradication program. We have confidence. I'll be clear here, Michael. We've got confidence in the program, the eradications program's response to this new outbreak. They were there within a couple of, within a day of the report. They're doing the delimitation around that area. They'll be, directly eradicating each of the nests. They'll be doing the work within a distance of it. All of those things, we've got confidence that they will be doing well professionally. The issue, though, here is each time we get these outbreaks, the ones at Wardell, at Moolumbah, they're now moving up north of Caboolture towards the Sunshine Coast, and this one out at Oakey. It is taking resources away from the central eradication program, and we do not have confidence that the level of funding for that main eradication program is enough to get the job of eradication done, even without these extra outbreaks.
Well, that's the question about surveillance, though. There may be other fire ants in nests on bases or land somewhere that we don't know about that have just come in somehow, maybe even on other defence land.
Yeah, so defence obviously is high risk because there's a lot of vehicles, planes, things moving all around the country from defence facilities. So we have, the Invasive Species Council, we have written to the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, yesterday saying that he needs to take this really seriously and order surveillance across defence lands where there has been movement from this Oakey base over the last few years. If you think about for context, in the Wardell outbreak south of Ballina, there was one nest. In the Moolumbah outbreak, when it crossed into New South Wales, there was five nests. We're up to 110 nests at this Oakey defence facility, and they have not finished checking that land. So this is really serious. This is an order of magnitude worse in terms of what it means for the program.
That is Jack Goff, who is with the Invasive Species Council, speaking to Michael Condon about this concerning outbreak of fire ants at Oakey. 110 nests found, and the entire base is yet to be completely searched and checked. And as mentioned, the outbreak means that fire ants are now in the Murray-Darling Basin.
G'day, it's Trent here from Catherine, and I'm here feeding Old Mate the crocodile. Yes, Old Mate is actually his name. He's 2.4 metres, and he's a saltwater crocodile. You wouldn't want to meet one of these fellas late at night. Take it easy, you're listening to The Country Hour.
Speaking of crocodiles, a traditional owner from Arnhem Land says he would like to bring in high-end paying clients to get rid of problem crocodiles. The Territory Government has released a new crocodile management plan for the next 10 years, and under that plan, up to 1,200 crocs will be removed every year. The government says it wants to see more Indigenous involvement in the crocodile industry. Jaida Gupalul from Northeast Arnhem Land says hunting problem crocs could help fund the conservation work of local ranger groups.
We propose to apply for permits under the Northern Territory Government Department to take potentially risky large saltwater crocodiles across the family's homeland areas of hunting and gathering places. The potential in providing high-end paying clients under these permits provides us with the opportunity to take these numbers of saltwater crocodiles to value add. And this would be financially high, delivering a range of diverse opportunities, including scientific research and management, training and employment opportunities, empowering young adult men and women with children while assisting them to reconnect to their culture, ceremonies, history, and being financially rewarded. Ranger groups across the territory struggle to get the type of funding and keep their operations survive and alive. So, you know, we are seeking the support and approval towards a sustainable use of saltwater crocodile live harvest commercially, supporting our monitoring and scientific research, data collection of the clients, and identifying new technology, safe and value-changing following the current code of practice under the current management plan.
That is Jaida Gupalul, who is from Northeast Arnhem Land, speaking to Matt Garrick. And if you missed Matt's story last night on 7:30, you can find it online if you head along to the ABC News website. Headline reads, NT Government unveils new saltwater crocodile management plan, stops short of mass culls. So this plan, it was out for public comment. The government has now made its decision and the figure of 1,200 crocodiles per year to be removed. It's more than what's been done in previous years, but it does stop short of those who are calling for a widespread cull of the species. As mentioned, you can read all about this online now if you search for ABC News.
G'day, it's Jeff Tucker from the Sydney Fish Market, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Darwin's iconic Mindle Beach markets return this evening. They're back for 2024. But as Mitch Abram from ABC News explains, the walk down to the beach this year might take a bit longer.
The markets will open for the first time this year from 4 o'clock this afternoon with a range of entertainment on offer, including a fireworks display at 8 p.m. before wrapping up at 9. But the traditional walk down to the beach for sunset will be a little different for opening night, with sections of the beach closed off because of erosion. Several sand dunes have fallen away due to the impact of wet season weather, while some of the walkways from the markets to the beach have also collapsed and have been closed to the public. The City of Darwin says it's working to carry out repairs as soon as possible.
So there you go. Mindle is back this afternoon. The beach, it's looked better. It's looked better. Hey, producer Dan, have you ever been to the Mindle Beach markets where they clap the sunset? That's normally me. This great sense of, I don't know what it is, when you start the clap and then everyone else starts clapping. I love it. I do it every time. We've got to go to the newsroom. It's 1 o'clock. See you back here in 5 for a chat with the Weather Bureau.
Andrew Dalgleish, Foxalicious Fruit, just out of Catherine. When I get a spare moment on the tractor, I like listening to Matt and the team on the Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon on this Anzac Day. In a moment, you'll hear the stories of three men who served in World War One. And then came home to the Territory and took up jobs in top-end ag. And before 1:30, if you've ever driven through the town of Catherine, just near the Tourist Information Centre there, you might have seen a statue of a man on the back of a horse. Well, today on the Country Hour, you'll learn about his story.
He was a horseman, he was a cattleman. Yeah, he was a pretty amazing man, not just as our dad, but for what he did, what he achieved for Indigenous people throughout the Territory, and for our mob as Waterman people.
That's all coming up in this second half of the Country Hour. In the first half, we got a fantastic song request from one of our Territory stations, Diggers of the Anzac by John Williamson. If there's a song you'd like to hear this afternoon, send it through on that text line, 0487 99 1057. I've got one here, a request to hear I Was Only 19. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Billy Lynch is there this afternoon. Billy, that southeasterly surge, where's it at the moment? What's it doing?
Well, it's definitely pushed through the Barkly today. Tennant Creek's been blowing about 40 k's per hour this morning, gusts nearly to 60 kilometres per hour. So that's where it is. In behind it, we've got those dry southeasterlies across central Australia. It's been, relatively cool, I guess. So Alice Springs got down to about 8 degrees this morning. It's only sitting on about 20 degrees at the moment. In those dry southeasterlies, the feels like temperature's about 15 degrees. So that's kind of what it's doing across southern NT. Ahead of that surge, we've still got a bit of humidity across the top end. So we had some showers and thunderstorms actually yesterday afternoon and the overnight period. Charles Point on the Cox Peninsula picked up 44 millimetres around 2 or 3 in the morning, this morning. Currently, we're looking at a few showers across the Arnhem District. They'll spread further westwards this evening and overnight. So could be a shower or two across Kakadu later today and then around the Darwin region overnight. And then that dry southeasterly is pushing northward, so it should reach Catherine tomorrow and then get right up into the northwestern top end by Saturday.
I'm just looking at the forecast for Catherine. That southeasterly might reach it tomorrow, but seems to be doing bugger all to its maximum temperatures.
They're stubbornly staying around the mid-30s.
Yeah.
Aren't they?
Gross, yeah. There in Catherine. 35 today and 34 tomorrow.
Yeah. Mm. We are seeing those minimum temperatures drop a little bit, though. So
a low of 17 on Sunday. That's nice to wake up to on Sunday morning in Catherine. But again, up to a top of 34. Ouch. How windy is it getting in the Barkly during all this?
Well, I mean, today we've seen gusts up to around 60 kilometres per hour. 56 was the strongest at Tennant Creek. So, yeah, it's pretty blowy. I mean, this surge, it's not the strongest that we've seen. We can certainly gust stronger than that through the Barkly. And then as these winds make their way up into the top end and the coastal waters, well, at this stage we're not planning on issuing any coastal wind warnings.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we've sort of got winds to 15 to 20 knots across our coastal waters today and then getting up to 25 knots from tomorrow and the weekend. So if you remember last weekend's southeasterly surge, that was quite a strong one. This one's not quite as strong.
Okay. Anything else we need to be aware of this afternoon?
No, not really. It's, not really a lot to talk about, just a few showers across the top end and then those dry southeasterlies pushing northwards.
Yeah, and still a little bit of rain there. Just looking at the Gove radar, looks like our good friends on Groote Island might be getting a shower or three this afternoon.
Yeah, my word. So, yeah, this dry southeasterly pushing up is probably not going to clear the showers from the northeast. They're probably going to hang around.
Uni. All right, then. Thanks so much for your time today, Billy. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you, Matt.
Billy Lynch there at the Weather Bureau. It's 10 past one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Our text number is 0487 99 1057. G'day to Val, who says, Matt, I'm travelling by road today listening to your program. Another song by poet and musician John Williamson. It's sad but relevant. I was only 19. Val, I'm just wondering, like, I'd probably go the Red Gum version if I was going to play it, to be honest. Producer Dan, do we know if that's been played already today? Because it is brilliant. It's in Val is right. It's as sad as all get out, but it's a very special song. At the moment, that's going to get the nod. I was only 19. If there's another tune you'd like to hear this afternoon, do send it through on that text number like Val has done, 0487 99 1057.
G'day, my name is Heather Smythe. I'm a sensory scientist and flavour specialist, and my job is to make food more delicious. And you're listening to the Country Hour.
And we've got a bit of Catherine history for you today, which is wonderful. Let's start with the stories of three men who served in World War One, and then came back to the territory and took up jobs in agriculture, and eventually were laid to rest in that Catherine district. Their names, Nugget Raymond, Frederick Prentice, and Alex Perry. One of the men, Nugget, he worked on Elsie Station near Matarenka and was actually mentioned in the famous novel We of the Never Never. Catherine historian Simone Croft says the men all worked in the ag industry after the war.
Well, the three men were actually working for different people, like farms and things like that. So they were returned soldiers of no fixed address, and they had employment on different farms and things like that. So Nugget Raymond worked just around the district doing all sorts of odd jobs. Yeah, well, Nugget Raymond worked for Aeneas and Jeannie Gunn on Elsie Station, and he was like a rouse about helping with agricultural aspects with their cattle, also helping growing food in the area for that station, and just basically a rouse about. But she writes about him as a character, and he's quite a loved character, and he was pretty well known around the Catherine district as well as Matarenka. But his later years he spent here at an old men's home. And he actually met the Queen in 63. He was presented to the Queen Elizabeth II. at the Katherine Airport.
And so there's another person that's from Newcastle Waters, you've told me. Is he from Aboriginal background?
Yes, he is. His name's Frederick Prentice, and he comes from a well-known family in Newcastle Waters. He served, and he's quite decorated. I can't give you all the logistics just off the top of my head, but he was quite renowned for what his service. When he came to Katherine, he was sort of around about mid-50s, maybe 57. He wasn't here that long when he actually died here in Katherine, but his medals came from, they found his medals perhaps about 8 years ago in Western Australia, and they were bought by the War Memorial in Canberra. So, and there's beautiful images of him, and also in Sydney. He had something to do with Sydney, so a part of his extended family. I don't know if I should say stolen generation, but he was adopted by the Prentice family.
Well, tell us about Alex.
Well, Alex Perry, we don't know a lot about him, but it was interesting because about 12 years ago, a name that comes up often in history is Les Cox, and he found this plaque out on the riverbed, and by another friend of his, brought the plaque in to Les and said, you know, do you know anything about this man? No one knew, but when we started actually researching, another lady, Shirley Smith, and I was researching it, we found out his records. And a bit of like what I said, he was getting away from a broken marriage after the war, nowhere to go, and he was just working on farms for the Russian peanut farmers. And because it was found out near Crystal Rapids, where the Russian farmers were all living at the time, just before the war and during the war.
And so why were these men so keen to come to Katherine or around Katherine? Do you know the incentive?
I think basically these men were basically broken men, and after World War II, marriages broken up, families disintegrated into nothing, so they came, settled here, got work, didn't have to provide accommodation, they would just swag it somewhere under a tree or on a station. So basically they just were trying to pick up their lives, and it was kind of a sad time because the territory was so remote and not much to offer, so it was basically all hard work and realistically no place for a woman.
That is Simone Croft, who's a historian at the Katherine Museum, speaking to Yanka Hoot. Now, if you've ever driven through Katherine, right near the Tourist Information Centre there, you've probably seen the statue of a man on the back of a horse. It's right near the Stuart Highway. Up next on this Country Hour program, you are going to hear his story. But first, let's have a song. Our text number this afternoon is 0487991057. Message here that says, g'day from Aidan, Ella and Georgia, who are listening to the Country Hour with their dad in the car doing a few errands. Great work, guys. And the votes are definitely in here. The votes are in. The people want to hear Red Gum. I was only 19. G'day to Dan in Nullumboy this afternoon. I hope you're enjoying the broadcast. It is, as Val says, a sad but relevant song. Across the territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. Now, on the main street of Katherine, near the information centre there, there's a statue of a man on the back of a horse. That man is Sabu Singh, who was the child of a waterman mother and Chinese father, and he was raised by the manager of the Wave Hill cattle station. He became a highly skilled and respected stockman who successfully managed to walk in two worlds. His daughter, Samantha Singh, sat down with Dan Fitzgerald to talk about her father and his legacy.
I guess I'm a little bit biased. He was my father. I'm the eldest of four children, and Yeah, he was a pretty amazing man, not just as our dad, but for what he did, what he achieved for Indigenous people throughout the Territory, and for our mob as Waterman people.
And tell us a little bit about his upbringing. Where was he born, and what was his first years of life like?
Well, I wasn't around at the time, but he was born on Delamere Station. He had a Chinese father and an Aboriginal mother, and he used to walk from Delamere right through into town, into Katherine, around the Mamblu, Katherine area. He had minimal schooling in his early years. He used to ride a push bike from Mamblu Station into Katherine to go to school with his mate Ralph Hayes. He went from Mamblu out to Wave Hill with his foster father after he'd been given to Tom Fisher to be reared, and then started his stockman years there, I guess. He got a horse when he was very young as a Christmas present from Tom Fisher. And he and a lot of the older Aboriginal men that sort of mentored him into what he eventually became, I guess, yeah.
And he did become a very renowned stockman. His bush skills. Tell us a bit about some of those skills that he had and the trade he plied.
Just a little bit of everything, I guess. He was a horseman, he was a cattleman, he did great leather work. He was pretty light-footed, you know, in the sense that if there was any sort of trouble, he was always really quick to jump in and assess the situation. Yeah, just lots. I think it was a lot of his upbringing from a very early age with his family that was instilled, and then it was just built on from there. It was just an innate, you know, sense of knowing. He just knew he could read the land. You would go somewhere with him and us as kids in the car, and he would point out all the way along the road, you know, landmarks, which part of the country we were in, which station we were going through, water holes, all of that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
And how did he go about sort of walking in those sort of two worlds of his background?
I think that for the time, he did it really well. It was a different era. He had mates that sort of stood by him and supported him in the sense of if he wasn't, you know, walking, if he couldn't get into a pub or a restaurant, his mates wouldn't go in with him either. They'd sort of say, no, we're not going in. If he can't come in, we're not coming in either. I think he handled it really well. He was a very unassuming, humble man. He had a great sense of humour, always up to different tricks, I think, with mates in his early days, but also growing up as kids, remembering him as always being lots of fun and always up for a laugh. Yeah.
There's now a statue of your father sitting astride a horse that's right on the Stuart Highway. How does it feel to you to have that as to be one of the focal points and a bit of an icon of the town, especially as tourists come through?
I think it's a great representation of all aspects of what he did, but not just for Dad, but for what he represents for the cattle industry as a whole. So whether it be contract mustering, bull catching, managing stations, helicopters, there's an array of different things that he did. And I think that I'm very proud of it. My kids and I are always, you know, saying hi, Dad, or his grandfather Peter, or telling people. And there are still people that are finding out. They haven't, you know, realised who it was. But my two children in particular definitely are always telling their friends or people that don't know.
That's Samantha Singh, the daughter of Sabu Singh, speaking there to Dan Fitzgerald. Next time you're driving through Katherine and see the statue, now you know the story.
New from ABC Books.
Huddled together, the Australian nurses told each other to be brave no matter what.
Lieutenant Colonel Vivian Bullwinkle was the sole survivor of a horrendous war crime in World War II. But it's what she did after that made Sister Viv an Australian icon.
Vivian's story shaped how the Nurses of Australia define themselves.
Sister Viv, by the award-winning Grant Lee Keyser. Book and audiobook available in bookstores and online.
Now, after 5 years of work, including extensive soil and water assessments, the CSIRO has finally released its water resource assessment of the Roper River catchment. This report is now up online. If you search Roper River Water Resource Assessment, there it is. It comes with a very flash promotional video. I'll give you a little taste of that now.
CSIRO, Australia's national science agency, has conducted an extensive study of the potential opportunities and risks for agricultural and water resource development in the Roper catchment of the Northern Territory. While the Roper's climate is hot and semi-arid, the Roper River has the third largest median stream flow of any river in the Northern Territory. It is relatively undeveloped, and existing irrigation in the catchment uses groundwater from the Cambrian limestone aquifer. On the heavy alluvial soils along the Roper River and its major tributaries, it is physically possible to extract up to 660 gigalitres of surface water. This could be used to irrigate up to 40,000 hectares of broadacre crops, which is equivalent to less than 1% of the total catchment area. However, cropping...
And it goes on, but that's probably the headline figure from this report. It's physically possible to irrigate up to 40,000 hectares along the Roper by using 660 gigalitres a year. So this is 5 years of work by the CSIRO. And on tomorrow's Country Hour, we're going to have a chat with one of the lead authors of this report. And it's a huge body of work. We're talking about a 506-page report. So if you feel like that this afternoon or tomorrow morning, go and have a look yourself. Just search Roper River Water Assessment CSIRO. There's the report, there's the promotional video, and I hope you can join us on tomorrow's program when we catch up with one of the authors. Keep it rural.